Hi there, I'm Kelly Goff, a longtime guest and occasional guest host here on Left, Right, and Center. Welcome. As always, Left, Right, and Center is your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. President Biden gave his first State of the Union address this week. The speech began with 12 minutes about the Russian invasion of Ukraine and then moved into Biden's economic priorities. Let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel to discuss it. I am your guest host and your center. I'm joined by David Dayan, executive editor at the American Prospect on the left. And on the right, Tara Settmayer, former Republican communications director on Capitol Hill and a University of Virginia Center for Politics resident scholar. Hello and welcome to you both.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to be back.
I'm going to start with an observation. When President Biden took the podium, I was struck by the image behind him in a way I did not think I would be. But I realized that every little girl in the country who sees their parents watching the news is now going to grow up thinking that a leader can look like Joe Biden, or she can look like Nancy Pelosi, or look like Kamala Harris. I'm assuming, based on both of your politics, you may not be huge fans of Pelosi or Harris, but I wanted to start by asking you both, am I growing soft in my old age, or does imagery matter in moments like this as much as I felt that it did when I saw this?
I think imagery matters. And it's funny, though, when you said that the image was striking, I wasn't sure if you were going to say because they were two women or because they weren't wearing masks. That was the other kind of striking moment, that almost nobody in the hall was wearing a mask. And this was, you know, part of Biden's kind of advance forward to a new phase of the pandemic, where there is some semblance of normality being reached. I don't want to discount from what you were saying, which is it is important to see the very first ever image of an all-female backing of the president, and hopefully at some point we'll see it in the front as well.
Tara,
I agree that. Imagery matters. We live in a visual age. And so all of those things matter. I just think that it also lost a little bit of the historic significance because of the ancillary issues going on at the time, with it being, you know, with the State of the Union, with the war in Ukraine, COVID. You know, it was probably not even mentioned in the top five most interesting things of that evening. Which I think is too bad, because it lost a little bit of its impact, I think, or the do of it. Like, wow. But then the flip side of that is it's become almost normal now, and it isn't that much of a big deal, which I think is a good thing, too. People should see that and say, yeah, that's the way it should be. Plenty of other civilized countries have had female leaders. And some have had presidents and heads of state that are women before the United States. So I think it's a great sign of progress. And I don't politically agree with Kamala Harris or Nancy Pelosi on a lot of policy issues, but I am proud to see them in those roles in this moment.
Well, people familiar with me know that I'm a fan of obscure political facts, and so I'm going to slip one in now. Vidas Finnbogadottir was president of Iceland for so long that there were actually young boys who believed only women were presidents, which I find that anecdote endlessly fascinating. So I think that's a powerful reminder that imagery can matter. But David, you know, it's interesting because when you mentioned specifically people not wearing masks, I was fixated on it when Biden was walking in, because, you know, he's not a young man, right? And I saw him shaking all these hands and really getting in there, which is one of the hallmarks of State of the Union with elected officials from all over the country. And then it was sort of like I almost forgot about it, which I guess speaks to the point you were making about our kind of return to normalcy. But I want to do a little bit of round robin really quickly. Tara, you've served in communications for elected officials. What for you was the highlight of the speech, either in terms of delivery or substance, and why?
Yeah, I'm actually a veteran of sitting through 7 State of the Union on Capitol Hill during my days there. And the first few were a bit more hectic and just kind of the allure of it all. And then after a while, it becomes routine a bit, you know, but they're still important and historic. And it was great to have an opportunity to witness them in person and get the feel for it all. So what I was looking for that evening was really how Biden projected, how he performed, because it was, in my opinion, the most important speech of his political career thus far after the inauguration, because the entire world's spotlight was on him. And it was more than just the regular State of the Union, which is basically pro forma in politics. I mean, it's important. We do have a lot of the pomp and circumstance, but the average American doesn't really remember the State of the Union unless there is something, a major gaffe, or unless we're in a moment in time where there's some trepidation in the country, you know, a la 9/11, things like that. And I thought that President Biden really stepped up to the plate. I think he overperformed. He looked extremely presidential, in command. And the brilliance of the speech, I worked for a former Reagan speechwriter, so I pay attention to structure and wording and themes and speeches probably more than the average person. And the way the speech was structured to include bipartisan applause lines, I thought was a stroke of genius, because we are so polarized in this country right now. It seems like we can't get along about anything. We can't agree on when the sun rises and sets. But you wouldn't know that pretty much based on the way President Biden's speech was received in the chamber. You had a couple of the traditional issues where Democrats were a little more enthusiastic than Republicans. But I was struck by how bipartisan, which is Joe Biden's signature, his willingness to work on the other side, across the aisle, but how bipartisan the speech was. And I thought it struck the right tone, particularly on the issues of democracy and the importance of our involvement in Ukraine and why that matters. And finishing strongly with saying, acknowledging that the State of the Union is strong because the American people are strong, which I think, whether it's true or not in real life, it made you feel good at the end, which is a win for the president.
David, what for you were the highlights?
I've never been to a State of the Union, but I noticed.
Don't be intimidated.
Well, I noticed this year that the members of Congress were having virtual guests because nobody could ever get into the hall. So in my mind, I was a virtual guest of everybody in the hall. A couple things were striking to me, and we can certainly talk about the Ukraine portion of the speech later, but I'm going to look at the policy section because I thought it was a really interesting in terms of what Biden was trying to do short term versus the long term. So in the short term, he picked a bunch of policies that are quite popular, increasing the minimum wage and a lot of parts of his agenda that are popular within the country. However, they don't really have a path to passage. I thought it might have been a better approach to talk about things that actually have a chance of getting done, things that he can do by his own executive authority, which were there but sort of buried in the speech, things that are being worked on a bipartisan basis. There's actually a number of pieces of legislation that are passing or have passed.
I was actually surprised at how high the number was, in fact, David.
Yeah. I mean, he did highlight the bill, the competitiveness bill. I guess he calls it now the bipartisan innovation bill. That's a major feature. But there was just so much of an emphasis on things like voting rights and things like prescription drug reform, which are very important. And presidencies do need to set the agenda in terms of telling the people what they're for and, who's blocking that progress. But if there's no real hope for a way forward on those things, it's just setting oneself up for failure in some way.
Well, for me, the highlights, it was sort of two-pronged. It was the moment when the president name-checked officers Jason Rivera and Wilbert Mora, who were murdered in the line of duty here in New York, and when the president reiterated that defunding the police is not the solution to solving our nation's criminal justice problems. And then he, right afterwards, vowed to crack down on gun violence, which elicited what a lot of us who have been in a black church recognize as the amen wave from Congresswoman Lucy McBath from Georgia, who lost her son Jordan to gun violence. Both commitments received pretty strong support, bipartisan support, particularly voicing his opposition to defunding the police, which seemed to go over not just across partisan lines, but across racial lines. And for me, part of why that was a high point is because there has been a narrative that has dominated media and politics, particularly since George Floyd's murder, that there is a significant racial and partisan divide on that issue, even though that's never been backed up by the data. In fact, Gallup found at the height of the coverage over Floyd and Black Lives Matter protest, 61% of Black Americans wanted the police presence in their communities to remain the same, and 20% actually supported increasing police presence in their communities. And so I felt that that moment was significant, right? Because everyone knows that Joe Biden was propelled to the nomination on the strength of older Black voters. So for me, those were high points because there's been a narrative that's dominated media and politics since George Floyd's heinous murder, that there is a significant racial and partisan divide on this issue of criminal justice reform, even though that's never been entirely backed up by data. I mean, I feel, as a lot of African Americans do, that there needs to be improvements. I certainly support banning chokeholds and more body cameras and all of the other things that we need to do to keep the public safer. But Gallup found at the height of coverage over Floyd and Black Lives Matter protests that 61% of Black Americans wanted the police presence in their communities to remain the same, while 20% actually supported increasing police presence in their communities, because a lot of Black Americans are also victims of violence, right? And so I felt that that moment in the speech was significant because everyone knows that Joe Biden was propelled to the Democratic nomination on the strength of older Black voters in particular. And so this struck me as him being very clear where his administration and most likely the National Party will stand on this issue in the upcoming midterms.
I agree with you 100% on that, Kelly. Just to, when I mentioned the bipartisan applause lines, that is one of them. I thought it was crucial that the president make it clear where he stands and where the Democrats stand on that issue, because Republicans have been exploiting it unfairly, to your point, since 2020. And with crime rates rising in cities, and, you know, we can talk about why or why that isn't happening, but it doesn't matter. In politics, perception is reality. So I thought that was a really, really important point that President Biden made unequivocally to try to push back against that narrative.
Biden has been saying that since the campaign, since 2020. And I don't think I expect or anyone should expect that the Republican noise machine is going to change and suddenly say, oh, well, Biden doesn't support that anymore. Or the Democrats don't support that anymore. I mean, their MO is to take, you know, something from the outer fringes of the Democratic Party and have it stand in for the party as a whole. I just don't know what it's necessarily going to accomplish, although it was a good moment in the moment.
It's great to make ads. It's just I have to push back on that for a second so people understand why I think it's significant. It's because you can make ads with it. And when you take that and you show Republicans standing up and clapping for the president saying those things, then you can counter the ads that come out to try to claim a certain candidate says that they're in favor of defund the police. So it's part of the communications messaging war. That's where it matters at that level.
Well, it's interesting, too, because we're going to talk a bit about this later, some of the primaries that have already taken place, that apparently that actually did become the defining issue in some of those primaries. But very quickly, we only have literally a couple minutes left. So if you guys could just say in one sentence what the low points were, I will say it was the person, the representative who heckled Biden, whose name I won't mention because that's what she wants. A high point, though, was that there was bipartisan denouncement of her behavior, as there should have been. For you both, what were the low points really quickly?
This is more of a joke, but Stephen Breyer acting all like, oh, but don't talk about me, please. He seemed like the person who threw a surprise party for himself and then decided like, oh, I'm so surprised.
Kara?
Well, I would echo your sentiment about the classless behavior of two particular members of Congress whose name I will not mention and give them any more attention that they don't deserve. But on top of that, I would say it was probably when Chuck Schumer stood up and clapped and didn't know what was happening, and it turned into a meme rather quickly. And it was like, oh, come on. With the political theater of the clap, I think, has become its own legend in States of the Union. So that was a little embarrassing.
I'll be back with Tara Sedmayor and David Dayan to talk more about President Biden's State of the Union address and the U.S. response to Ukraine. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from across the political spectrum. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Kelly Goff, your guest host. On the right is Tara Settmayer. She's a former Republican communications director on Capitol Hill. And on the left is David Dayan, executive editor at the American Prospect. Okay, the president started his speech with a strong and forceful declaration of support for Ukraine and the Ukrainian people. Is the United States doing enough, though? Economic sanctions, troops being sent to NATO countries, cultural sanctions. Is this enough, David?
Well, the real sticking point on Ukraine is the fact that we have an energy crisis right now. And the U.S. and even more so Europe doesn't want to do anything to raise those energy prices more than they already are. And so despite very strong economic sanctions that are really aimed at weakening the Russian economy as a whole, there are limits to it because they have put carve-outs for energy deals within all of those sanctions. And so we continue to essentially fund this war by proxy by continuing to buy Russian oil and Russian gas. And there's no way out of it. And really, this shows the limits. We've heard for years the U.S. talk about its energy independence, the fact that we produce more energy in this country than we use. But oil is a global market. And when even though we don't buy a lot of Russian oil, when that supply gets constrained, prices are going to go up. And in conjunction with our allies, it's even more so in Europe. So the failure to invest in renewables, the failure to invest in real energy security, is showing now in the geopolitical realm with respect to Russia.
Tara, do you think we're doing enough?
Yes, I do, actually. I was concerned initially that we weren't. But at this point, the level of economic sanctions we're seeing are unprecedented. And my inclination, of course, to want to go in and blow them all to hell because we see this humanitarian tragedy unfolding and the authoritarian bully and murderous dictator that Putin is, what he's inflicting on the democratic country of Ukraine is in war criminal territory at this point and only probably getting worse. But I also know that we have to have prudence here. And short of setting up no-fly zones, which is basically getting involved in the war directly, there's not much more we can do other than maybe expedite getting the lethal weapons and equipment to Ukraine so that they can continue to fight and as bravely and competently as they have. The Ukrainian people have been unbelievably strong, and that's inspiring. So, you know, to the point of including the oil and gas companies and those sanctions and being a little tougher on that, I understand the desire to do that. I also understand that there's a bit of a conundrum here, to David's point, that Europe has to, Europe depends a lot more on Russian oil and gas than we do, considerably. And in order for those level of sanctions to be imposed, you have to have unanimity within the EU. And you're just not going to get that because so many of those countries have some at to the point of 75% rely on Russian oil and gas. So I think that the Biden administration has really adeptly navigated this entire strategic alliance in Europe. This is something that we haven't seen in decades, and there is a purpose to it. So the Russians, the oligarchs targeting their yachts and their apartments and their playgrounds across the Western world, that is smart. It is hurting Putin domestically. And we have to just be prudent with this because we cannot get into a kinetic war with Russia at this point.
Today on Left, Right, and Center, I want to really talk in depth about the coverage itself. I will be honest and say that when I first heard murmurs from certain corners that people felt some of the coverage of this conflict was, quote, racist, I was a bit taken aback because as an African American, I'm very sensitive to that word being overused and ultimately potentially losing its power. And so I'm not a huge fan of the so-called, I think they call it the suffering Olympics, right? I believe all people facing tragedies and inequities beyond their control deserve empathy and adequate coverage. But I have to say that I spoke with a friend who teaches at Columbia Journalism School, and she said she is actually using coverage of what is happening in Ukraine as a textbook example of bias in coverage, and more specifically, that there is extreme bias in newsrooms in determining which crisis and which conflict warrants extensive coverage, how they are covered, and also bias in terms of which stories audiences are more likely to read, to relate to and to read. So I did my own little kind of digging, and I wanted to just kind of share some of the evidence and get your take. So first, I'm going to cite a few examples that, and a hat tip to the Washington Post that rounded up some of them, not all of them, but some of them. So while reporting from Ukraine, CBS News foreign correspondent Charlie Diagata said of Ukraine that it isn't a place, with all due respect, like Iraq or Afghanistan that has seen conflict raging for decades. This is a relatively civilized, relatively European, I have to choose those words carefully, to city where you wouldn't expect that or hope that it's going to happen. He eventually apologized for his remarks. A BBC commentator became emotional on air, noting that the deaths of European people with blue eyes and blonde hair being killed, it moved him to tears. And a British member of parliament wrote in The Telegraph, "They seem so like us. That is what makes it so shocking. War is no longer something visited upon impoverished and remote populations. It can happen to anyone." Again, those are just a couple of examples. There are plenty more that people can easily find online. Now, my first reaction was, well, what other conflicts could theoretically be sharing space side by side with this story on the front pages? And I found a horrifying story on the number of babies and other hospital patients who have been dying in Tigray recently because of the nearly 16-month conflict that continues in Ethiopia. But while that piece was in The Guardian this week, I had to dig for it because it's generating very little coverage. David, you're an editor at a major publication. How would you rate the coverage of foreign affairs and this war in particular in most newsrooms? And what could newsrooms be doing better?
Well, I'm glad you brought this issue up. We have a Turkish national working on a piece on this right now. The sort of Eurocentrism that we see in the coverage, you know, as the only descendant of Europeans on this panel, I'll say that I'm certainly appalled by it, and not just by the coverage, but by the actual policy and what's not being discussed within that. If you look at what is happening in Europe in terms of their immigration system, they're mm-hmm. allowing Ukrainians to live and work in their countries when you know, so many Muslims, Africans seeking refuge over the last several years have been met with absolute stonewalling by most of Europe.
And David, I hate to interrupt, but there's also been reports, which I'm sure you have heard, of people who are of African descent who live in Ukraine who have not been permitted to leave.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, I have heard of that. So, it's a question of choice of are we going to draw out these distinctions, these dichotomies? Are we going to set this in the proper context of, you know, several wars that have been perpetrated over the last months and years? Are we going to set it in the context of what we're doing right now in other countries? I mean, there's this move to freeze Russian central bank assets that is striking in the context of the fact that the United States has frozen the central bank assets of Afghanistan and left that country to a position where millions might starve, and trying to give that money to 9/11 victims in an ongoing legal case when the Afghan people who would be most affected by this, literally taking food out of their mouths, had nothing to do with 9/11. So it's very important, and I as someone who tries to direct coverage for my own magazine, I take it very seriously.
Tara, I want to bring you in here, and I want to start by just mentioning there was a 2008 study by researchers from The Ohio State University published in the Journal of Psychological Science that found we are naturally more empathetic to people who look like us. So that has implications all over the place, right? From the criminal justice system to medical care and to coverage. So I wanted to ask you, as someone who works in media now, how much of this conversation do you think is about diversity in newsrooms?
I think there's an aspect of that to it, because when you have diversity in newsrooms, you have diversity of perspective and real life experience, where the decision makers can actually are more sensitive to some of those issues that you wouldn't have before. It just comes from life perspective, and that's why diversity across the board is important. And as someone who actually is half European, my great grandparents emigrated from Germany and Italy, and they came over at a time where my great grandparents left when Germany in the 20s was becoming a place that they didn't think was a good place for them to be after the Nazis started to recruit my grandfather's brother when he was 10. So I look at the implications of what's happening in Europe as well, from the perspective of the historical perspective of how Europe was impacted by what happened in World War II, and where the parallels are, and why what's happening with Ukraine and what Vladimir Putin is doing with Russia and trying to change the security posture and international order in Europe is of great importance to all of us, including here in the United States, in that fight for preserving Western democracy. You know, I think that there are the idea of confirmation bias is real. I don't think it's new. But it just speaks to the fact that it's important to have varying perspectives, particularly in places where decisions are made and how news is covered. This is a prime example of why that's important.
I want to bring in our special guest because she can also help us talk about where we are in terms of both the coverage, but also in terms of day-to-day policy actions on what's happening in the Ukraine. We're joined now by Kristen Soltis Anderson. She's a Republican pollster and founding partner at Echelon Insights. Hi, Kristen.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I did want to get your take on cultural sanctions, which have gotten less coverage than economic sanctions. So, for instance, Russia will not be included in the Eurovision International Song Contest. The chief conductor of the Munich Philharmonic, Valery Gergiev, was fired for his refusal to condemn the war of Vladimir Putin, whom he is close to. And the Metropolitan Opera announced that it will sever ties with Russian artists with government ties, including conductor Gergiev, who's previously conducted there, and the opera star Anna Netrebko, who has performed at the Met and is a known Putin ally. She's withdrawn from several international engagements. The list is growing. People seem divided on this. On the one hand, economic sanctions, you know, seem to be somewhat effective. On the other, cultural sanctions seem to strike some people as well-intentioned, but potentially not necessarily effective or fair, because plenty of artists don't always have power, even when they're famous, and often the arts are their way out of a dangerous environment. I always think of, you know, the fact that the American Ballet Theater, which I love, was lifted in the 70s and 80s thanks to Mikhail Baryshnikov and Alexander Godunov defecting and starting their lives here. Some listeners might know Godunov from his role in Die Hard, but a lot of us appreciate what he did in the ballet world. So that's a long-winded question to ask you this. You talk to voters. What is their take? Are people willing to kind of give up on artists in the effort of this war? What do you think cultural sanctions will end up? How are they perceived by voters?
Well, there isn't a lot of polling out there about specifically the removal of, say, Russian artists from the public square. We do know that coming out of things like the Olympics, that there was a lot of frustration around things having nothing to do with the conflict in Ukraine and having everything to do with, for instance, doping and the Russian Olympic Committee and what have you, that already there was a little bit of sort of negative sentiment out there. And you've now seen this spreading, where you've got viral videos of people dumping out vodka. It was reported there is a major international cat federation that has said they will be banning Russian cats from their competitions.
Wow.
I don't think you can argue that Russian cats have anything to do with what's the atrocities that are occurring in Ukraine. But there are, I think, some of these cases that are a little bit on the bubble. So I'll confess I'm a big fan of Formula One racing. And it was just announced that the Russian driver in Formula One, Nikita Mazepin, will be losing his seat on his Formula One team because some countries, the UK, for instance, has said we are potentially not going to allow Russian drivers to drive in these races. Now, on the one hand, you may say, well, it's not this, you know, young 20-something driver's fault that his country is pursuing a horrific foreign policy. On the other hand, he is the son of an oligarch who is part of these meetings that Putin has. And so I think, you know, it's while there's not really a lot of polling at this point, I do think we see an enormous amount of appetite, and it is crossing party lines, for very tough action that falls short of military action, but uses every other lever possible to place pressure on Russia to say that what they are doing is wrong.
I've been talking with David Dayan, Tarasette Mayer, and Kristen Soltis Anderson. We'll be back with more Left, Right, and Center.
Thanks for listening to Left, Right, and Center. Is there someone in your life who could benefit from hearing a civilized discussion from all sides? Share the show with them. You can stream all episodes at kcrw.com/LRC, straight from the KCRW app or wherever you listen to podcasts. We want your feedback. Consider leaving a review at Apple Podcasts. And thanks.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Kelly Goff. On the right is Tarasette Mayer. On the left is David Dayan. And our special guest is Republican pollster Kristen Soltis Anderson. So let me start by asking you, first off, I know that historically, with very rare exceptions, like 9/11, foreign affairs is rarely an issue that swings election. Can you tell me why that is? And do you think that it will be different this year because of what's happening in Ukraine?
One of the big reasons why foreign affairs is rarely a top issue is in some cases just pure proximity. That when you are dealing with an economy where people are either struggling to get jobs or, in this case, struggling to afford cost of living, you have a pandemic that people are grappling with, they're worried about their kids' schools or they're worried about issues like crime or immigration or what have you, things that really are directly touching their lives, something like foreign affairs just feels further away. It's less immediate. And so it's something that voters are a little more likely to, frankly, outsource to leaders they trust. You can take something like Russia, for instance, where back during the Obama administration, Republicans were much more likely than Democrats to say they viewed Russia as a big threat. When Donald Trump comes into office, the lines on the chart cross. And that's not necessarily because your average voter is being affected directly by Russia back in 2014 or 2018, but they're taking signals and cues from leaders about it. But I think an interesting way to think about what's happening in Ukraine now is to think about the situation in Afghanistan less than a year ago. So the withdrawal from Afghanistan, you had horrifying images splashed across the television. You saw people in polls really rapidly changing their views to, you know, say, well, yes, I want us to withdraw from Afghanistan, but not like this. But you never really found Afghanistan to still rise to the level of top issue. So people's views on foreign policy, I find to be more malleable than on, say, something like healthcare, education, something that they feel they're dealing with day to day in their own communities. It's something where they defer more to leaders that they trust on their opinions. But I would also say that just because it's not a top issue doesn't mean it's not important. The withdrawal from Afghanistan was not a top issue for most voters, and yet it did fundamentally, you know, you can look at the trend lines. It was right around that time that suddenly ratings of Biden's leadership, his strength as president, those sorts of things began to fall. And as perception of the administration's competence began to decline, voters may not be thinking about Afghanistan specifically when they go to the polls in November, but these big headline moments can undercut more fundamental perceptions of leaders and their capability of leading.
Well, the challenge to that, to Kristen's point, is that it does feel far away initially. It does have implications in everyday lives when it comes to trade, manufacturing, cost of goods that have to be imported or exported, or small businesses that are caught up in trade wars. supply chain issues. We saw that during Christmas time. People feel that. They may not know why. They may not know the geopolitical implications of it, but they understand how it impacts their lives every day. And where that translates into political weapons is when Republicans are very good at simplifying the issue and Democrats have a tendency to overcomplicate it and trying to explain all of the ins and outs of it versus trying to put it into a more easily digestible, relatable message to the everyday voter. And that's where you run into this disconnect and the importance of perception. So when we talk about energy, I would counter that perhaps on the global scale, striking a deal with Iran could translate into opening up barrels of oil that may bring down oil prices globally and help Americans. But if you look at it from a political perspective, it would make more sense to have the message of opening up the strategic oil reserves in the United States and approving more gas and oil leases for drilling in the United States so that we're not dependent on international oil. That would go over a lot better, I think, in the United States than saying, oh, great, we struck a deal with Iran. So the political implications of how you message this matter every single day. Same thing with manufacturing in China, which was another reason why, back to the earlier conversation about high points in the State of the Union, that the idea of buying American, building American was a bipartisan applause line that challenged Republicans to be supportive of that approach to things where they may not have been before if somebody else had said that.
Kristen, you attended the conservative conference CPAC last week, which often sets the agenda for conservatives. So I just want to shift gears. I've been in media now over a decade, and there was a time when if producers or bookers called me and said, Kelly, I'm looking for a smart, nice conservative for a segment. Do you have suggestions? I could easily give them five names of friends I'd been on the air with for their segment. And now it seems like, first off, I have friends who were Republicans, but who have since left the party. And two, I have friends who, because they either did or did not support the previous occupant of the White House, they may or may not be considered an acceptable conservative guest on certain programs. So I wanted to ask you, Kristen, based on your polling, who is the, quote, typical American conservative right now? Like, what's their age? Where do they live? What issues do they care about? Who do they consider their leader?
Sure. So demographically, you're looking at someone who's probably a little older than the median age, certainly someone who is more likely to live in a rural area, someone who's maybe a little more likely to report going to church, if not every Sunday, at least a couple of times a year, a little bit more likely to be white, although perhaps not as much more likely as you might expect. But overall, I think there are a lot of different ways, you know, we can use the term right to mean a lot of different things. I wanted to take a look at this in my data. And so I said, okay, let's say you've got three different ways you can kind of count as being part of the right. Either you're someone who really likes Donald Trump, you're someone who considers yourself a Republican, or you consider yourself to be a conservative. And it turns out about 43% of the country fits one of those descriptions, but only 13% of the country meets all of those descriptions. So there is, I think, a lot of diversity in terms of how far people are at through each of those different doors in terms of being a part of the right. Now, the percentage that I think, you know, would fall into, and Tara, I would be interested in your take on this. I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but this bucket of, well, I'm conservative, but I'm not Republican, and I do not like Donald Trump, is a very small piece of the electorate. It's 6%. And I find that that's a group that really does get an awful lot of media attention because it's kind of interesting, right? It's this, hey, these are folks that have, you know, anytime somebody sort of disavows a movement that they were once a part of, that's very interesting. But the reality is that 6% is a very small slice of the electorate. And so I do think, while I understand this reluctance to sort of elevate extremely Trumpy voices in many spheres, that there really are a lot of Americans who do fit this definition of the right, that even if they're not very favorable to Trump, they're at least somewhat favorable. They probably wouldn't be describing Biden's State of the Union as brilliant and things like that. And I do think that's important to keep those voices represented.
I'd like to follow up with Tara on that, because I think the other thing that's interesting, though, Kristen, is that there's a lot of data, as you know, coming out of places like Texas, which is my home state, which is showing that particularly among Hispanic voters along the border, they actually wouldn't be identified as firmly Republican, although some of them did vote move to Trump specifically over border issues, which I know strikes people as counterintuitive, but it's not to those of us who are from Texas and know that border issues are actually very important, including to people who might not identify as conservative, particularly those who live right along the border. And there's also been a lot written lately about the growing number of young Black conservatives, some who support Trump and others who support Black Lives Matter, but also want their taxes lowered. So I wanted to ask you, Tara, where do you see the party headed, the Republican Party? I know that you have left for now, but do you see your leaving as a permanent, and to Kristen's point, or do you think there are a lot of people out there like you who might not go on air and say, I'm leaving the party because of Donald Trump, but people who might simply say, I'm up for grabs?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't discount the 6%, if that's what it is, of us who are still consider ourselves conservative, but no longer identify with the party because of the direction it's taken, thanks to Donald Trump's ilk. So because as close as elections are these days, it only takes a couple of percentage points to swing an election, particularly in swing districts, to make a difference. Even Steve Bannon recognized that about all you needed to do was to siphon off about 4%, and Republicans would lose. And we saw what happened with Joe Biden, and how many Republicans who were disgusted by Donald Trump and where the party had gone and decided it was time for new leadership voted for Joe Biden in 2020. Now, the issue becomes, where do they go from here? I think you're seeing a growing number of people who feel politically homeless, because they're not happy with either party, or they are the more moderate right or left of center folks who don't feel comfortable on either side, which is growing. The unaffiliated is the largest growing segment of the voting population today. But the way our elections are set up with primaries, whether they're open or closed, the more passionate voices on either side are the ones that dominate in primaries if it's not open. So the way our system is set up, you kind of have to pick sides oftentimes. But I don't think we should discount the growing number of disenchanted voters who are in the middle in this country, because they can really swing elections. Now, where do I see the Republican Party going? Right now, I'm dismayed by the direction of the party. It's become an illiberal party that is seemingly playing footsie with authoritarianism. It has gone 180 degrees on a lot of issues that were the hallmark of what defined conservatism, fiscal responsibility, for example, clearly defining our enemies overseas and standing up for democracy. We're not seeing that. We're seeing some very loud voices welcoming in some authoritarian voices like Viktor Orban in Hungary or Bolsonaro in Brazil. And what Donald Trump did in foreign policy seems to be off brand for what Republicans, establishment Republicans, used to believe in foreign policy. The culture wars I'm concerned about, because we see, even though that's been a part of Republican orthodoxy for a long time, but not to this point. And the people, the extremes, are the ones that are getting the most attention. Mainstream Republicans, like the Mitt Romneys of the world, or Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, are considered apostates because they don't subscribe to what Donald Trump is demanding. He's still the titular head of the party. If you look at the behavior of Kevin McCarthy and others in leadership in the Republican Party, they're still pledging fealty to him. And I think that's unfortunate.
I mean, I think the most interesting thing that happened this week with regards to Republicans was this proposal that came out from Rick Scott that actually defined, or tried to define, what in his mind Republicans would do if they had power. And one of the bullet points on it was to give everyone, quote unquote, skin in the game by raising taxes on what he said was the 47% of Americans who don't pay them. And this caused an absolute four-alarm fire in Washington. Mitch McConnell coming out. There was another part of the proposal that said we should sunset Social Security and Medicare within 5 years. And McConnell said, you know, we're never doing that. We're not getting anywhere near that. So it seems to me that the GOP is not really concerned about creeping authoritarianism in their ranks. They're not concerned about the various comments by their fringy members. What really freaks them out is if it gets out to the public, the implications of their economic policies. And that seems to me to be the most telling moment that occurred recently with respect to Republicans.
We're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid. Kristen Soltis Anderson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. David Dayan, it's your soapbox.
Well, one of the more overlooked parts of the State of the Union address was about ocean shipping, which is not the sexiest topic in the world, I'll admit. But if you believe that Democrats must do something about inflation to have any shot in the midterms, it's critical. The big ocean carriers, which is a consolidated and deregulated industry segmented into three main alliances, earned $190 billion in profits in 2021. That was five times more than the industry earned from 2010 to 2020 combined. That goes into the cost of every transported good. Studies show that just ocean freight rates are responsible for about 20% of the current increase in inflation. There's a regulator called the Federal Maritime Commission that can challenge ocean shippers if they find illegal price gouging, but the commission has next to no staff and a $30 million budget. So the White House plan devotes resources from the Department of Justice for investigations into anti-competitive conduct and price gouging. We in the media are too often busy examining the latest tweet outrage to step back and look at what's really causing problems in our society. And usually, as in this case, it has a dollar sign attached to it.
Tara, what's your rant?
So my rant this week is actually completely pop culture-y. And usually I have a political rant, but this one is because I am a cat lover. And as a cat mom, I have to say that I am really encouraged by some of the cat memes that have come out showing the softer side of the Ukrainian military. They have been posting the famed military cats of Ukraine. And I think it's wonderful to see how soft power plays into the imagery of the barbarism of war, because I think Vladimir Putin underestimated what his propaganda war would do. But the Ukrainians have been really brilliant at using soft power and their ability to communicate throughout social media and across the different social media platforms by showing pictures of Ukrainian soldiers and cats. And I'm here for it. And I'd like to say that I'm glad to see that places like Poland are allowing the refugees leaving Ukraine to come in with their pets, which is critically important to people. Pets are part of your family, and you shouldn't, it's bad enough they have to flee their home country. They shouldn't have to leave their pets behind. So kudos to Poland and the other countries who are letting pets come in with the refugees there. I'm encouraged by all of that.
For my rant, I recently had the pleasure of visiting my 100-year-old grandmother. It's mind-boggling thinking of all of the changes she has lived to see in our world, from the creation of television, the internet, and cell phones. But obviously, some of the most profound changes are those involving the experience of women and African Americans in society. Due to segregation, she had extremely limited educational opportunities and spent much of her life, like many African Americans in her community did. She picked cotton and worked as a domestic. But she always loved to read and passed her love of literacy and education to my mother and me. So you can imagine how moved she was when, despite her limited education, a resident at her care facility said that she's so intelligent that had she been born another time, she might have become the first Black woman on the Supreme Court. But alas, my grandmother was born a year after women got the right to vote, and decades before any woman or Black person would join the nation's highest court. But she has lived to see our country elect its first Black president. And now she has gotten to see Judge Ketanji Jackson become the first Black woman nominated to the Supreme Court. The vocal support Jackson has received from bipartisan corners seems to make her confirmation look likely. But for many of us, she has already succeeded simply by fulfilling the dreams of so many who came before her, but had the misfortune of being born at the wrong time. That's all we have time for today. Thanks to David Dayan, Tara Settmeyer, and Kristen Soltis Anderson. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Laura Dine Million. Our production assistant is Nisha Vincut. The show is recorded and mixed by Nick Lamponi. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. And I'm Kelly Goff. Thanks for joining us. Tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.